So thank you, Ambassador Chowdhury, for taking the time to speak with the Global Observatory. Today we would like to survey with you key geopolitical challenges in Asia, particularly South, Southeast Asia and East Asia. We all read and we know the geopolitical cloud and economic might is shifting to emerging countries in the East and in the South of the world. Very recently, the US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton writes in the current edition of the Foreign Policy that US must fully commit to exercising a leadership role in Asia. How do you see these geopolitical changes in the region in the next few years?
Thank you, Francesco. It's always a pleasure to be here and always a pleasure to talk to you. It's absolutely true that there is a shift occurring at this point in time in global power. But this shift to Asia is not something new. Asia has always been, in the past, in the pre-colonial days, in the center of global power. It was a cradle. It has been the cradle of ancient civilization, both Chinese and Indian. Therefore, what we today call the rise of Asia generally is actually a re-rise. It's rising again. And this is an inexorable historical process that began some time ago and is coming to fruition now. The great challenge for the world is to be able to manage the rise in a way that it is positive. A relationship with the United States is a critical element in this rise or re-rise. I shan't call it leadership, perhaps, but what is called for is partnership, because there are in many ways Asia leads as well. The idea is to work together towards goals that would lead to greater global economic and political stability.
What are, in your opinion, the key challenges that the region is facing and will have to face in the next decades?
Well, there are both political and economic challenges. Asia's rise is or re-rise is largely economic. India and China are sort of leapfrogging the economic advance in ways that that are truly remarkable. At the same time, there are challenges of great poverty in Asia. There are swathes of India which are poorer perhaps than sub-Saharan Africa. So on the one hand, you have wealth. On the other hand, you have poverty. At the same time, Asia is developing or has the intellectual resources to address these questions of poverty. I think about Bangladesh, for instance, I mean, which has been able to alleviate poverty, expand women's empowerment, education, etc., in a way that is truly remarkable. That is also happening. This kind of progress on socioeconomic indices is happening across Asia. There are several specific political challenges. Afghanistan being one of them. It's a political challenge. There are challenges of Sino-Indian rivalry that has to be managed. There are challenges of growing military power that has to be also controlled and managed in a way that Asia does not experience the kind of situation that Europe confronted in the first half of the 20th century.
Now, many of the challenges you mention has a transnational dimension. And nonetheless, multilateral cooperation and regional integration is still quite weak in Asia. How can international cooperation be strengthened? And how can this be, in some way, reconciled with the state's concerns over limitation to state sovereignty?
You see, the West, mainly Europe and the European countries, they have experienced the kind of state sovereignties that you're talking of for a long time. since 1648, as a matter of fact, the Treaty of Westphalia, which was the watershed point in evolution of nation states. For Asia, this is a largely a new experience. Asia went under, most of Asia went under colonial domination for much of the 19th and half of the 20th century. So the nation states are still not as sharp as they are in the West. There are still cross-national ethnic connections. Afghanistan, Pakistan, for instance, the Sistans in the north, for instance, as well as in South Asia. Sometimes there is a intellectual and political confusion as to whether to stress commonalities between nations, as is being done in Europe, or to stress the distinctiveness in order to underscore individual sovereignties. So those are some of the theoretical problems that nation states in Asia will have to address and resolve.
Do you see an European model as something that can inspire some kind of unity, not necessarily across the entire continent, but on specific areas of Asia, or there is still a very long way to go?
Okay, this is an interesting question in the sense that there is a lot of Asian thinking focused on this. We in Singapore, for instance, have done a lot of thinking in this regard. Kishore Mahbubani has written profusely on this. We talk of an Asian home concept. This is what ultimately there would have to be linkages among the great Asian civilizations in a way that the Europeans have reconciled differences among themselves and are leading to one Europe. More difficult to achieve in Asia because the Asian civilizations are more distinct than what France and Germany were, or Italy for that matter, in the past. Chinese civilization, Russian civilization, Indian civilization, these have been distinct. The idea is to be collaborative and cooperative and to strengthen the concept of Asianness. There are those who believe that Asia itself is a Greek concept, I mean, to start with. Today we are redefining Asia and in some ways developing an Asian identity, which was not always there. So those are some of the challenges. So the ultimate fruition of having a united Asia in the way that Europe has evolved into already is still a distant dream, but not necessarily not achievable. It is achievable.
You already mentioned a couple of times Afghanistan and Pakistan, and let me ask you a more specific question on these two countries. They experience conflict and instability for many years. Both countries face and are source of threats from terrorism and violent extremism. Where do we go from here? What are the effects of the worsening U.S.-Pakistan relationship, for example, and of a closer Indian-Afghanistan relationship?
This is a very complex question, very complex situation as well. What is happening in Pakistan is a sad story in some ways. Pakistan was used, and effectively so, by the West, to be very frank, during the Russian occupation, and Pakistani support was essential to bring about an end to the Russian presence in Afghanistan. And thereafter, many Pakistanis feel that they're dropped like a hot potato and left with the consequences of the Afghan crisis. As a result, you have this proliferation of weapons in Pakistan. You have these rivalries among the Pashtuns and others. The consequent rise of radicalism also is largely attributed to the political events of the 1970s. So you have a situation which is also dangerous because Pakistan is is reportedly has 105 or so nuclear warheads. It's a very powerful country militarily. It has at least 700,000 men in arms. It has one of the largest conventional militaries in the world. And it is a country which feels itself under existentialist threat. It's an unsated state, and therefore hugely problematic. Now I think we are looking to a period in Afghanistan when the Soviet, the American withdrawal will take place. There will be a Western withdrawal, and this is something that I think is beginning to become an Afghan aspiration. They are looking to a point in time when foreigners would have left the country. In that case, what kind of Afghanistan shall we see? It has to be an Afghanistan committed to models of development, models where there is spread of education, where women are empowered. Culturally, there will be resistance to any initiatives that look at these as objectives. But there would have to be interventions, not military interventions, most certainly not, but social and economic interventions by the rest of the world and supporting the development of Afghanistan into an effective post-conflict nation. Not easy. It will not be easy. There has been always the history of the great game in Afghanistan, when Afghanistan has drawn rivalries from among the big powers all around it. But today we have across the street the United Nations, etc. We have institutions who are mandated to ensure that national rivalries do not become sources of conflict to the disadvantage of populations, the peoples of the world for which this institution of the United Nations has been built.
Finally, 2011 has been the year of dramatic transitions in the Arab region. In Asia, Malaysia has seen a number of reforms in recent weeks, and at the moment the world is eagerly watching Myanmar and see what the development will be in that country. Can we say that we can see pockets of sort of an Asian spring in some of these countries?
Well, doubtless parts of Asia are in the cusp of great changes. The Arab world, certainly. The Arab Spring is a very apt expression because many Arab countries have been under the yoke not foreign, but even their own domination by elements within the system. Parts of Asia that we are talking about, South Asia and Southeast Asia, are today largely democratic in any case. So these two situations are not comparable. But the fact remains that, in other words, what the Arab countries are striving for perhaps has already been achieved in large parts of Asia. But there is no end to human aspirations. Naturally, what we want to see in Asia is the strengthening of democratic institutions, which are largely or broadly exist in many of the countries that we are talking about here, but a strengthening of the institutions in a way that governments reflect popular values, that economic advance takes place, that women are not suppressed. And systems, states learn that it is better to live with an uncomfortable law or uncomfortable situation than to try and suppress it, you see. So that is the essence of democracy, or an uncomfortable idea for that matter, than to try and suppress it. So that is the essence of democracy. Yes, changes are taking place everywhere, which is not different from any other part of the world. The whole world in a flux, and ever since the time of Heraclitus, we have believed that you never step into the same river twice, and you don't do it in Asia as well.
Basil Chaudhary, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.